Welcome to Whiskey Shenanigans. I'm your host, Randy Warren. Whiskey Shenanigans, where we help our listeners experience the world of whiskey, every aspect of life, as if it was accompanied by a glass of bourbon. The sports world on whiskey. Basically every part of life on whiskey. Whiskey Shenanigans is about getting exclusive interviews from Bourbon Row in Kentucky, where we can learn about the secrets that make our favorite bourbons unique. We will get inside the hearts and minds of many distillers and help you understand what and how they are achieving it. Whiskey Shenanigans is about going beyond boring podcasts featuring just tastings. Heck, what do you get out of that anyway? It's about bringing on guests and experiencing the entire world through whiskey. But be warned, if you're diving in and you want to participate in these riveting discussions, you will need to grab a glass or a dram and be prepared to be entertained. Hello again, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. We are really, really happy to have with us today John Rempe, the master distiller of Rebel Bourbon. And Rebel is an old and storied brand. Lots of good stuff happened at Rebel. Thank you for joining us today, John.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we're going to learn a little bit about what you guys are doing. And, you know, we're always interested in the new and the innovative and all that kind of stuff. But we'll get to that, too. So tell me a little bit about the past. Where did Rebel, how did you guys make your mark?
Well, and with Rebel, you know, just strictly with that brand, we purchased that brand back in 1999. I actually started with the company in 1998. So the following year, we got this brand, very, very excited to get this brand. Knew about this brand long ago when I was much younger. A lot of people have stories. I talk to people all the time. They've always got stories of Rebel, back when it was known as Rebel Yell, but now it's Rebel. But so this bourbon, the heritage goes way back to 1849 at the Stitzeroa Distillery. It's that weeded bourbon mash bill. It's that non-traditional mash bill. So it's corn, wheat, and malt versus corn, rye, and malt, which is a normal traditional mash bill. You know, we'd like to say that just from the get-go, it was already a kind of a rebel in terms of the way it's being made. But 1999, we purchased that brand. We've had it since then, and we're using source whiskey originally, as we did for all of our brands back at that time. But in 2018, we opened our distillery here in Bardstown, Kentucky, and I live right here on the grounds here of the distillery, and get to wake up and smell the mash of Rebel cooking every day.
Wow, that's incredible! That is so cool. So you. I heard that you had like a signing outside your window, since you live right there, right? And like a bunch of people queued up for some kind of a special release or something.
Well, yeah, that was my my blood oath. That is a release that I do every April. It's a new pact of blood oath. It's something different every year. And this past April we had our pact. Pact 11 release or 12. I don't know. I've been done so many of them now. They're run together. But our most recent release here late in April. And like I said, I live right here on the grounds. And I wake up that Saturday morning. I get woken up because I can hear people. I'm a well ways away from the main entrance of the distillery. But I hear them outside my windows. And we had around 300 people in line for that release here. So that was incredible. It's just still kind of a surreal feeling. Going back to when I started this brand and up to where we are now, and then just the interest and the following. And we've got some pretty diehard fans of the brand now, and they come in all the time, and it's just it's wonderful to see.
And on that particular day, how many bottles did you sign?
I signed over 900 of the Blood Oath bottles that day. That was we probably within about an hour and a half, 2 hours in the morning. I mean, everybody that came through, that's one thing that I do in all these releases. I make sure that I am here, and I will sign everybody's bottle. So We had the one line for people purchasing the bottle, and then the line for people waiting to get their bottles signed. And I mean, but they brought other bottles. They brought older bottles that they had. They've even purchased other bottles here in the distillery. So yeah, I mean, it was probably around, when all was said and done, probably close to 1,500 bottles total that I signed that day.
Did your hand fall off at the end of the day? I mean, that's a lot.
It does get a little cramped after a while. With the blood oath, though, looking at that, it's my I'm right-handed, so I'm signing with my right hand, but my left hand is the one that really hurts and is sorest the most, because trying to hold that box that each bottle comes in, I just kind of slide open the front lid of that and then sign it. So, yeah, but I love it. I would not do it at all. I love it.
Right. Wow. That's incredible, man. And it's really good for the fans and the people who love the bourbon that, you know, you're accessible and you're willing to be out there and you're willing to sign all these bottles for these people. And it's a good thing. I mean, it sort of warms the heart. I like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of my favorite things to do. Obviously, I love coming down, interacting with customers in our retail shop, talking about whiskey, talking about the bourbons that I make, and just watching them enjoy it and taste that. I love watching them taste it, and then when they smile, they're like, that's good. I'm like, yeah, that's my favorite part of what I do.
So tell me the story, the old story. I know you've told this story before, but tell me the old story of Rebel Yell and Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and all that.
Yeah. The story is, it's been corroborated. Mick Jagger, there you can search on Google Mick Jagger Rebel Yell, and you'll see him just kind of leaning back and holding up a bottle of the old label Rebel Yell. And the story was that he was on tour with Billy Idol at the time, the Rolling Stones were, and they were partying one night and they were drinking that Rebel Yell, and that's how the song, a Billy Idol song, Rebel Yell, came into existence because of that night.
And Billy's just like, that'd be a great title for a song. I think it is a great title for a song. That's it reminds me of the 80s, you know, when that's.
Oh, definitely.
You know, and that's sort of my era, you know. Hate to admit it, right. but
that's mine too. Yeah.
Back in the college days, or even high school, really.
Late 80s was I was in college. I was born in 69, so yeah, I grew up in the 80s.
Right. So that's a cool story. I mean, there's not too many brands out there that have a story quite like that one. They can, hey, look at all these famous people that love our product, and name songs after it and everything like that. Yeah. So I happen to be a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. And when we go to Steelers games, they always do this, this song, a Renegade from Stiff from the 80s.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like that thing. It's like at some point Renegade became synonymous with the Steelers. And the Steelers became synonymous with Renegade. And so in the fourth quarter, when you need a big defensive stop, the whole stadium goes black. And it's kind of like that thing. You know, it's like you kind of get, associated with these sorts of things, famous sort of things that happen. And the whole stadium goes black. And then all of a sudden it just comes on and everybody just goes wild. And, the opposing team, I would like to say they hate it, but I think they're so amazed at what's going on. What are you doing? Yeah. What is this that's happening?
That's pretty cool. I didn't know that. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I've never been to a game there.
And so. Billy Idol. Billy Idol's doing the same thing. He's like, what is this? What is this great drink that you guys are enjoying? And we gotta make this into something cool. So, and when did you drop the Yell part of Rebel?
That was probably 6 or 7 years ago, maybe, I guess. Maybe a little bit, a little earlier than that. But yeah, it has been that long. Yep.
And that was just to disassociate
really, we wanted to completely, turn the focus of that brand into your rebel identity. Everybody's a rebel. I mean, real rebels is what, we call it, everybody is a real rebel in some way. And it's just focusing on kind of embracing your, you know, that spirit of, I'm not going to be told what to say. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to play by my own rules. And that's really where that's what the brand identifies as.
I love that because, that's what kind of, makes everything tick, in the whiskey world is all the new stuff and everything that people are working on. You got to be a little bit of a rebel. I mean, it's a very traditional industry. But within that traditional industry, and let's talk about Blood Oath. I mean, what you've done with Blood Oath is just incredible. Tell us, like, how did you come up with that? And what's the story behind it?
Yeah. So Blood Oath, that was a brand that I created, started creating about 13 years ago. And, I really wanted to come up with something that was, I didn't want to just put some old whiskey in a bottle and put a nice label on it and a big price tag on it. That's just boring. Anybody and everybody is doing that right now. So I really wanted to create more of an experience for that bourbon connoisseur, that customer that really appreciates a little bit of creativity put into it. And that really knows what they want out of a bourbon. And so I started with the first pack. I did three separate Kentucky Straight Bourbon whiskeys that I go out and I got them from around distilleries in Kentucky, and I blended them together, and it was wildly successful. We put the notice out to our distributors that, we're going to open up ordering for this, and it was sold out that day. So the next year came along, and I went to the higher ups at Luxco, and I said, "Hey, I want to do something a little different. I'm going to do a port finish on this." And they said, no, that sold out in one day. Don't change it. And I said, "Well, I can't keep doing the same thing every day or every year. It's going to get stale. And I want this to be something that people look forward to." So I started doing barrel finishes on it. And when I first did it, I did get a lot of negative comments from some people, the more traditionalist in the industry and outside of the industry, because there wasn't a lot of those finishes going on. There were some, but not nearly as many as there are today. So I remember, I was told, "Hey, this better work, or it's on you." And I said that my name is on the bottle. I'm not going to do something that I don't think is going to work. So just trust me and let me do what I want to do. So they said, "Okay, it's all you." And then I did it. And then pack two came out. That was the port finish, and another wildly successful one again, sold out that first day, and going on up to here. So, that's just, if you talk about the rebel attitude, I like to think that I have that in me a little bit, where I'm not going to be told what to do, and just to try to keep it safe, play it safe. I'm not that person. I'm going to go out, I'm going to push some boundaries, and I'm going to see how far I can go with some things.
I think that's totally consistent with the whole rebel idea. And let's not overlook the oath part of this too. What is the oath part of it?
So the oath part of it, I'm a kind of a history nerd a little bit, and that's why I would be Blood Oath. It's got that old world type script on the label. And so I wanted that term Blood Oath in the packs, it signifies that pact that I have with the consumer, to where they're going to trust me on this. And I'm not going to answer a lot of questions on Blood Oath. I'll give you some basics. I'm not going to talk about the mash bills. I'm not going to talk about where I'm sourcing these bourbons from. The only thing I say is they're all Kentucky Straight bourbon whiskeys. They're older whiskeys. But I don't want to give too much information on it, because I found over the course of my career that too many new whiskeys that come out are judged before the bottle even is opened, because they know what distillery it's from. They know what the mash bill is. I don't like that. I don't want that. I want it to be judged on how it tastes. I think that's how it exactly should be. So the whole Blood Oath and the pack thing is, this is my pack between you and me. Just trust me on this. You're going to love it, but I'm not going to tell you where, because I want you to open that bottle. I want you to taste it and then tell me what you think of it.
That's the way it should be done. I agree with you 100%. Why judge the bottle before you've even tasted it? You know, I mean, it's just because it came here, has this mash bill or whatever. Oh, I'm not going to like that, or oh, I'm going to love it. And then you put too much hype behind something that you think you're going to love or whatever. And it's just, it can go both ways. But, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me. Judge it based on what's in the bottle and, you know, really what you like.
Yep.
Yeah. Another thing that drives me a little crazy too is when I have people come in and I love all of our customers that come in, but I get people coming in and they'll say, hey, do you have pack three that I can sip? And I'll say, no way, we haven't had pack three. We sold out, we sell out and it's gone. And they'll say, well, I got a bottle in my basement bar, but I don't want to open it. And I was just wondering what it tastes like. And I was like, I make it to be drank. I mean, that's the one thing that drives me crazy is they got these things. They're just setting them up as trophies, which I appreciate and I love, but I kind of want people to taste it too. That's kind of why I make it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm guilty of that myself in the sense that I open every one I get, you know, I don't save them. If I really think that the bottle was special, here's a little tip for the listener. Take some iced tea, put it in your empty bottle, put it back on the shelf, put a little mark on the bottom of the bottle so you know it's iced tea and not bourbon.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Go back to it.
One thing that I like to tell them too, when I'll have people down in there, and I'll sign their bottle and they'll say, well, now you signed it, I can't open it. And I say, yes, you can. I say, get a marker, one of these little paint pen things that I'll use to sign the bottles. I say, get one of these. And then when you have your good friends over or you know, relatives over that you like, and you want to share something special with them, when you pour, hand the marker to them, have them sign the bottle, have them date the bottle. And then after, you know, however long it takes to for that bottle to be empty, once that bottle is empty, you have all those signatures and dates on the people that you shared that bottle with. To me, that's worth more than the bottle, to be honest, those memories.
Great idea. I love that idea. That's the first time I've heard that. That's a great idea. You know, that's what this is all about. I mean, we talk about culture and, you know, of whiskey and in America and all this kind of stuff, but it's really about friends. It's about family. It's about, you know, it's about making deals. It's about, you know, doing, you know, consummating business transactions. It's, bourbon is great for all of these things. And to have people just put their, you know, put their little dates on it and sign it. Yep. Like, hey, I tried this. This is great.
Yep.
I like that. Yep. I'm going to do that from now on.
Yeah.
I like that idea. Yeah.
It was driving me crazy. They weren't going to open the bottle.
Where can I get some Blood Oath? It's hard to get your hands on it, isn't it? It sells out.
Out in the market, it can be a little bit tough. It's very limited. I mean, we don't do that many bottles of it. We're doing about 17,503 bottle cases, and that's it. That's got to go all, you know, in all 50 states, and some of it is even going over to the UK and over in Ireland too. We have it here at the distillery. We actually got more allocated for our distillery retail shop than we ever had before, because I'd hate it turning people away. But finding it out in the market, I mean, most of these places the ones that are actually even going to get bottles out there at retail, they're most likely they never even hit the shelf, because these places, you know, they've got their preferred VIP customers. They're going to get a call and say, hey, Blood Oath came in, come down and pick it up.
Yeah. Come down, get it. Yeah. Because it's going to be gone in 5 minutes if you don't get your work down here. Right?
Yep. Exactly.
That's great. Do you guys do any like barrel picks or anything like that?
Not with Blood Oath, but we do with Rebel and with, our Ezra Brooks brand. We do that too. And with, this year, something special. I did a estate bourbon with some corn that I grew, back in 2019, 2020, but here at the distillery. That's our Lux Row brand. It's my estate bourbon. We're doing some barrel picks in that. Not many, doing about 25 total. But for Rebel, we're doing a 6-year bottle and bond pick. And for Ezra, we're doing the old Ezra single barrel pick.
6-year bottle and bond. Nice. And for Ezra, what was it?
That's the old Ezra 7 barrel pick.
7-year barrel pick.
Seven-year, yep.
Nice. I'm planning on coming out there soon. Maybe I'll look you up.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'm trying to arrange a trip with a couple of other people in the industry to all of us go out and, you know, put our name on a couple of barrel picks for
nice
some big a big restaurant group in Washington D.C.
So. Gotcha. Yeah, definitely let me know. I'll make sure I'm here and we'll have some pours.
Definitely. Oh, that'd be so fun. That'd be so fun. So you also told me one time that you did a root beer barrel.
Yeah, I'm doing it. It's not a root beer barrel. It tastes like a root beer barrel candy. This is my it's our latest re-release in our Rebel line, which is our Rebel root beer whiskey. That was a flavored whiskey that I came up with years ago, and it did pretty well. But we had to pull it from the market. We just didn't have the wheated bourbon for it to keep supporting that while also, trying to just support our Rebel 100 on the shelf. So we had to pull it off just, to conserve some of the whiskey that way. But now we've got plenty of whiskey for that. So last year I said, I want to bring this back. I think that, we get people that come in the distillery all the time. And even when I'm out in the market, I get people asking me, are you going to bring back the root beer? Bring it back. So we brought it back. It's the exact same formulation, and it's outstanding. And I went through probably, maybe 20, 25 different root beer extracts that I was adding to the whiskey. I wanted it to taste like those little root beer barrel candies, a little spicy root beer note to it. It's not overly sickeningly sweet. It's just got that little root beer spice. And one of my favorite things, I was just in Michigan a couple weekends ago doing a tasting. We had a NASCAR race up there where Rebel is on the car also. I was tasting it and so many people, they'll look at me and they're like, this tastes like those root beer barrels. And I said, exactly. That's exactly what I want. It's like, just like those little candies. It's really good.
That's a good shooter. That's incredible. You brought that back again. That's really cool.
Yep. Yep. It's selling well right now.
Is it readily available or is it hard to get your hands on?
Well, I mean, right now it's still kind of in the beginning stages of getting it shipped out to all the distributors. But I mean, I was just out of the market and a lot of places they do have it, and it's available across the country, all 50 states. So it should be on the shelves.
Okay.
Anywhere you go now.
In all. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
If you don't see it, don't see it on the shelf, ask for it. They'll get it shipped in.
So just because we're interested, I'd like to know how you got into this. Like, how did you get associated with Rebel, and what made you get into this business?
Yeah, so long story. I mean, I've been in this business now for going on 28 years. It will be in October. I actually originally went to school to be a doctor. I was going to be a family doctor. Family practitioner. That's what I wanted to be. And I was actually in pre-med at St. Louis University. And our family doctor, who was friends with my parents, he came to me and he said, so you want to be a doctor? And I said, yeah. And he said, why? And I said, well, that's what I've always wanted to be. And he said, but you don't know anything about it, really. And I said, well, I don't know. Maybe I do. Maybe I probably don't need to know more. And he said, come work with me a little bit this summer, and at the end, before you go back to school, I'll ask you if you still want to be a doctor. And at the end of the summer, he came in and said, so what do you think? And I said, hell no, absolutely not. It is completely different than, this romanticized version that everybody has in their head of what, a doctor is. And he opened my eyes up to a lot of things that, you don't think of. And so I didn't. I graduated pre-med, from St. Louis University. And then I just went out and I was like, I'm just going to go start working somewhere. So I got a job as a microbiologist at a soft drink plant, did that for a few years. Then I went over to a startup fruit juice company. And I think I was like 25 or 26 years old, maybe. And I designed their production facility and helped build their production facility and ran that for a couple of years. And then one day I just got a call from a headhunter saying that there was a distilled spirits company in St. Louis, Missouri, looking for a lab / R&D guy. And I said, I'll give that a shot. And so I got the job. And so I was their R&D manager for a while, then worked my way up to director of research and development. We weren't distilling anything at all back then. We were just buying bulk finished alcohols from various suppliers. So we were buying
Scotch from Scotland and Canadian whiskey from Canada. We're buying tequila from Mexico and rum from down the Virgin Islands at the time. And I just started becoming very curious on how they're making all the distilled spirits, and you know everything from mashing, fermentation, and distillation and maturation. And so I started traveling to all these places and learning how to do it. So I spent a lot of time up in Canada, Western Canada, just in Alberta, just south of Calgary. There was a distillery up there, and I learned how to make rye whiskey and some different vodkas, Canadian whiskeys. I've spent probably, over the course of my career, if I combined it all, probably about a year down in Guadalajara making tequila down there at our with Rodolfo Gonzalez at their tequila distillery in Guadalajara. We've got more than one now down there. I traveled a lot over to Ireland also, and I helped, or I actually learned how to make Irish cream liqueurs. That's what I modeled my bourbon cream liqueurs are. I do it the way that they did it over there. I'm not using any kind of a non-dairy creamer, or I'm not using high fructose corn syrup. I use all natural, all real dairy cream in those, just the way that I learned over there. So I learned how to do all these things, and I was down in Kentucky making bourbon for a while. And when we decided to build our own distillery, Don Lux, and then our COO, then David Bratcher, they came to me and they said, "Hey, you want to run this distillery that we're building?" And I was at the point in my life where I could get up and move. So I said, "Yeah, absolutely." And they said, "Here's a little bonus. There's even a house already on the property here at the distillery that we're going to completely gut the whole inside and renovate it, and that you can live there." I think that was just a way to get me to be at work 24/7. But I mean, yeah. So I moved here in 2016. We started building the distillery that year. It took about 2 years to build. We opened our doors here in 2018, and I came in and I figured out the mash bills that we were going to use, the yeast strain, and everything from all of our fermentation set points, our column set point. I mean, everything, from zero to 100 go. And I take a lot of pride in what I've done here. I put a lot of hard work. I put a lot of sleepless nights into this place over the last 8 years. A lot of distillers, they'll go into a distillery where it's already up and running, and it's already established. They're already making bourbon, and they just kind of take over. But I'm very proud of the fact that I can come and I can say I was here when this was just a field, built this thing from the ground up on a greenfield site, and developed all the processes and everything, all the procedures here, and we've got incredible bourbon coming out of this place.
Absolutely, that's a real great opportunity, obviously, for you to put your stamp on this thing and really make it special and make it yours. And you've done everything you touch turns to gold, John.
I'm gonna be knock on wood now.
Anything not turned to gold? Tell us about a mistake. Any mistakes along the way?
There's always mistakes. Always, I call it learning. I'll call them mistakes.
Learning, yeah. That's how you get better, right? You learn.
Exactly.
So mistakes either bring you down or you learn something you didn't know before.
Exactly.
I like that. Fantastic. Well, we really appreciate you being on with us today, John, and we really appreciate Rebel and Blood Oath and Ezra and everything that you guys are doing there. It's really fantastic. And when I'm out there, before I'm out there, I'll give you a shout, and we'll see if we can do a barrel pick or something.
So I can set that up. I know a guy.
I'll bet you do. a guy.
No, I look forward to it. I had a great time talking with you, and looking forward to you coming out here. We'll sit on the patio of our old stone house that was built in 1806, and we'll sip some bourbon.
That'll be awesome. Thank you so much, John. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
All right. Here we are again, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. Today, we're going to talk about barrel finishing. Is barrel finishing innovation or overkill? In the past year, I've interviewed for Whiskey Shenanigans podcast, really, dozens of master distillers, including Buffalo Trace and Bullet, Heaven Hill, Rebel, Jefferson's, Four Roses, Johnny Walker, Michter's, Glenfiddich, Woodford, Maker's Mark, and so many more. Why do we talk with these people? To find out about the innovations that they are working hard on and get a glimpse at what new things are coming soon. For each and every one of them, or I should say each and every one of them, is working hard to bring you new expressions, and the trends are constantly changing. Ultra-aging techniques are abounding. But finishing techniques are still very important. It appears that buyers are not experiencing what some might call novelty fatigue, but rather look forward to and even covet the continuing parade of new releases and new expressions. And Kentucky is happy to oblige. What is finishing? There are specific requirements for whiskey, as you probably know by now, to be called a bourbon. And one of those requirements, by the way, is not that it has to be made in Kentucky. Common misconception, doesn't have to be made in Kentucky, just has to follow the requirements. Since the requirements include a prohibition of any kind of additive, the one tool left in the toolbox, and by additive, you know, you can't add honey to your whiskey and call it a bourbon. Honey bourbon. You can call it honey whiskey, but you can't call it honey bourbon because it's not a real bourbon if you add something to it like that. Can't add vanilla. So since requirements include a prohibition to additives, the one tool left in the toolbox for the distiller is creating a fully compliant bourbon, then dumping the barrel out into a second barrel. Due to regulations, you could not just keep the first, you could not just skip the first barrel. You have to do the first barrel because the first barrel is what allows you to comply with the regulations and actually be able to call it a bourbon. In order to be called a bourbon, that first barrel has to be brand new, unused, American oak. But wait, once the first barrel maturation is complete, the requirements have now been met, and it is officially a bourbon. Now, after the initial requirements have been met, you can take your official bourbon and dump it into a second barrel for what they call finishing or further maturation. And the key is that this second barrel does not have to be brand new American oak. It could be a barrel previously used to age other alcohols, such as Oloroso Sherry or Pedro Ximenez Sherry or Port Madeira or Marsala, red wine, rum, cognac, even champagne. Almost all the master distillers that I've talked to on the podcast are using some kind of finishing technique. For example, if you've been listening, you've learned that Jefferson's Ocean is not a gimmick. It actually works. It's not really barrel finishing, but it is part of the maturation process, and it is unique to Jefferson's. If you're not familiar with their story, it's interesting. They take their barrels on a journey on the ocean, just like the old days when barrels moved from Kentucky down the Ohio River into the Mississippi, all the way down the Mississippi and around the Gulf, up the East Coast to major population centers in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York City, and Boston. Jefferson's reproduces that journey, and then they add to it. After New York City, they sail back down the East Coast through the Panama Canal and up the West Coast, cross the Pacific, all the way to places like Singapore, and then back again. The agitation of the ship movement adds to every drop in the barrel, becoming more exposed to the barrel wood. And the changes in climate as it moves around across the equator add to the whiskey breathing in and out of the wood and picking up more and more colors and flavors. One distillery that stands out, because they don't really do barrel finishing in secondary barrels, is Four Roses. They already have 5 yeast strains and 2 levels of rye in their mash bill. So they have the ability to create 10 different recipes or 10 different flavors within their core offering. So you might conclude, well, they don't really need to do additional finishing because they can get all the flavors they need from these 10 different recipes that they're working with. However, they have an anthology series, which is an ultra aging technique that brings you 20 plus year old bourbons. Rebel Bourbon produces what they call Blood Oath, which is the master distiller's pact with you, the customer, to bring you something unique each year that you will love. He's not going to tell you all the details about it. He's not going to give you the mash bill and, you know, all how long. Trust me, that's what the pact is. I'm going to bring you something great and you're going to love it. And the results have been outstanding. And if you can get some Blood Oath, I'd recommend you picking some up. Whiskey Shenanigans has even tried finishing. We created a recipe and we had it distilled, short aged, and shipped to us. Then we finished it in the same style that Maker's Mark finishes their barrels, by adding staves into the wood. That means like additional slats of wood into the barrel. And you add those staves can be different types of wood. They're not additives. We're not adding, you know, vanilla or some flavor. We're adding wood to the barrel. And that wood can stay there for 1, 2, 6, not up to maybe 9, 12 weeks. And you got to keep tasting it all this time until it's just right. So they start with standard Maker's Mark, then add staves to it. Whiskey Shenanigans distilled our own recipe, and then we added a stave to it, which is something you can buy off the internet, a corkscrew stave that doesn't take up much space and gives you a lot of surface area, and is a new American oak stave. Turned out real nice. Thus, finishing has become a pretty significant tool to bring you new flavors for existing bourbon products. Some of these turn out to be exceptionally good and become limited editions, rare, and incredibly valuable. There you have it, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. It's pretty straightforward. Finishing is the real deal. The vast majority of these people are doing it. And that's because it's adding flavor. It's changing a whiskey. It's maturing that whiskey. It's bringing out new flavors that weren't there before. So enjoy.
What is interesting and what I'm always like drawn to, you know, if I watch the Kentucky Derby, I'm always drawn to the story of somebody that made it there against the odds. In bourbon too, and I think what I love about it, there are these wonderful, beautiful stories from these families all across Kentucky and how their brand survived, how it's evolved, how it's changed. And then the cool thing is that in which I wasn't prepared for until I like met my first master distiller, I realized, oh wow, all they want to do is tell stories, and they'll unlock every ancestry discussion you could ever want to hear.